In the next world, actual narratives are personal experiences, compiled and elucidated by A. P. Sinnett, London Theosophical Publishing House, 1 Upper Woburn Place, West.C. 1 reprinted 1918. Introduction. Whether from the point of view of ordinary religious belief or from that reached by theosophical teaching, most people look forward to some kind of life hereafter, but are rarely enabled to frame conceptions of that life with any degree of detail. And it not infrequently happens that when people who have passed over get an opportunity, by the methods of ordinary mediumship, of communicating back to friends in physical life, they seem mainly desirous of reaffirming the familiar truth that to be happy hereafter one must be decently well behaved in this life. The warning as a rule makes no deep impression on the hearers, because no particular novelty surrounds the idea. Insofar as it fails with so many people to become a commanding motive of action, that is probably due to the end of page number 7, vague mist of uncertainty that envelops all future conditions of existence. If people who pass over would devote their efforts to giving us minute descriptions of the new circumstances in which they find themselves, that would make a much deeper impression on their friends here than can be produced by ethical sermons, however earnest, however inspired by new knowledge and genuine conviction. I have been for some years past in the enjoyment of opportunities favorable for getting free speech with friends who have passed over into the astral life. For many reasons it is impossible for me to go into minute detail concerning the circumstances under which these opportunities have arisen. For those who do not know me, the narratives I am about to record may seem tainted by a fictitious coloring. I can only say, for the benefit of those who do know me, and may trust my word, that the stories in all cases are here passed on just as I have received them, and are published in perfect good faith to meet what I hold to be a very widespread desire for definite information concerning the actualities of astral life. Of course, we must always remember that such astral life is not to be regarded as a fulfillment of the karma in each case engendered on. In all earlier theosophical teaching it was so supremely important to establish, on a firm foundation, the great principle of reincarnation, with its attendant doctrine of karma, that the intervening phases of life on the astral and manasic planes were comparatively neglected, with the result, indeed, of giving rise to some misapprehensions in regard both to the astral and devachanic conditions. Those of us who are the most earnest students of theosophical teaching and best situated for carrying on such study, are most fully appreciative of the insuperable difficulty of setting forth the whole volume of complex law governing human evolution all at once. We need not regret the omissions that were inevitable in the beginning. We need not hesitate to welcome fresh information which fills up some of the gaps, even though in some cases this may dissipate impressions too hastily formed when information was incomplete. As an introduction to the fragments of astral biography I propose now to give out, I must set before the reader in fairly intelligible shape the constitution of that vast region enveloping the earth that is referred to when we speak of the astral plane. Many of its characteristics have been vividly described in early Theosophical 9 writings, but for the purpose I now have in view it is desirable to remind the reader of the very definite way in which it is divided into subplanes. Subconcentric spheres would be a more appropriate phrase, but the usual term plane is more convenient, though we should never forget that the whole astral region with all its subdivisions is a huge concentric sphere surrounding the physical globe, as much a definite appendage to it as the atmosphere, and carried with it in its movement round the sun. A part of the great sphere is actually immersed or submerged beneath the solid crust of the earth. That is a terrible region with which only the very worst specimens of humanity have any concern, after passing on from the physical life. Two subplanes of the astral are thus underground, the first and second, numbering the series from below upward. The third lies just above the surface of the earth, and is still a region of varied discomfort, in which those whose personal characteristics are such as to require purification before they are qualified for existence on any of the superior regions, spend a time greatly varying in duration. The fourth subplane is the first on which existence is altogether based upon the sensation, 10, of happiness, though its experiences are themselves subject to very great variety. The higher regions again are all conditions in which happiness is a background of consciousness, but in which different mental and moral attributes find their appropriate expression. Thus people in whom intellectual activity is the predominant characteristic are naturally drawn to the fifth subplane, while the sixth affords scope for genuine devotional feeling if that is the predominant element in any given character. And just because life on the higher levels of the astral plane involves the principle that people are drawn together by their real sympathies, not as in physical life by karma, that often, down here, puts people into close relations with antipathetic entities. The seventh subplane is a region to which those gravitate who have been in life rulers of men in one way or another, not merely by high social rank, but by virtue of characteristics that have given them sway over others either in industrial or political life. Of course, we must always remember that from the higher levels of the astral plane it is possible for those belonging there to descend, at will, to any of the lower. They do this constantly when desirous of observing what goes on here on the physical plane. There is, 11, thus much freedom of intercourse among people on the higher levels of the astral world. I must pause here to emphasize the idea that life on the higher levels of the astral world is very much more than a transitory condition of preparation for something higher on the manasic plane. That was the first notion we had about astral existence, and it was defective in more ways than one, not so much an incorrect statement as an incomplete one. For large numbers of very good people, the astral life is little more than a transitory condition, not because they are preeminently good, but because they may not combine with their goodness enough intellectual capacity to be able to make use of the higher regions of the astral world. Granting such intellectual capacity, people so endowed find it desirable to stay for very protracted periods on the higher levels in question. The Devachanic state, in short, which at first was represented as the goal towards which all people should aspire on passing over from the physical life, is really a thoroughly happy state of dreamy inactivity, with intensely vivid sensations of blissful emotion, but not one of either usefulness to others or individual progress. There are large numbers, perhaps multitudes, of people at this stage of human evolution who are good enough for the Devachanic state and not advanced enough in other ways for a useful or progressive career on the higher levels of the astral. And to these large numbers the earlier teaching applied quite accurately. Does this statement conflict with a long familiar teaching to the effect that all progress is accomplished in the earthly life, that the period intervening between two earth lives is a period of rest, that it is not an opportunity for further progress? That early teaching was not wrong, but was easily misunderstood. It included, the reader may remember, the idea that karma could still be made on the astral plane. Though at first this idea was treated rather as a warning than as an encouragement, but, properly understood, it operates both ways. In truth, the complete view of the subject is that the life of causes includes the astral as well as the physical life. If the astral life for people of the, intellectually, humbler classes is just a period of waiting for idle Devachanic bliss, then it is best that no fresh causes should be engendered on the astral plane. They might be detrimental. But consider for a moment the condition of a truly great man of science, for instance, with the new opportunities, 13. Afforded him in the astral world, he has boundless scope for the prosecution of study far beyond the opportunities of physical life. Of course, he avails himself of these, and for more reasons than one. To begin with, the interest of his enlarged opportunities is intense. He could not endure the idea of turning away from them merely to steep himself in slumber's holy balm. And again, for such a man could not fail to come into touch with the high wisdom we call down here occult, he would know that the increasing knowledge he would be gaining, even though it might not be specifically passed on to his next life, would engender enhanced capacity for acquiring knowledge in the next life, and would not be in any sense of the word thrown away. This is how it comes to pass that, as a matter of fact, the higher levels of the astral world are still the home of all the great scientific men whose names have decorated our intellectual history. They scorn the unprofitable enjoyments of the devachanic state. At some period in the future they will have to pass onto the manasic plane for the sake of effecting the complete union of all the spiritual elements in their permanent egos which must precede reincarnation. But there is no sort of hurry. 14, and again, their touch with high wisdom will enable them to know the right time at which to pass on a second time, just as they unconsciously obeyed the impulse of an unseen law when they passed on from mere physical existence. That very rough sketch will suffice for the moment to render intelligible the narratives of personal experience on the astral plane that I am in a position to deal with. I will begin with one that has to do with the after-death experiences of a man with whom I had some touch in this life who had some tiresome characteristics to work off in the beginning. But, as the reader will see, a magnificent volume of spiritual karma in the background which ultimately found complete expression. In this case I shall be able to give the story in his own words, or nearly so. The conventions by which we are troubled in this life are such that for public print one must exercise a certain reserve in describing conditions that are the outcome, on the astral plane, of strong sexual feeling. And here a word or two of preliminary explanation is perhaps desirable. Bad karma of the kind that is distinctly related to the relationships of this plane, can only, as a rule, be worked off or, 15, find expression on the physical plane in a later life following that in which it is engendered, but where strong sexual feeling has been very imperfectly gratified, and has remained a powerful force in imagination up to the period of a comparatively early departure from this life, it is an impediment to upward progress towards higher astral levels. This will be better understood as my present work proceeds, and the subject may conveniently be reserved for later treatment, with some of the stories I have to tell as its text. I will call the subject of my first narrative G. R. 16, G. R.S. Story. I died at Hong Kong a good many years ago, at about the age of 30. I had contracted the fever common in that region, and had only been ill a short time. One evening in the dry hot weather, lying in bed heated and feverish, suddenly something seemed to snap like the snapping of a piece of thread. All feeling of malaise and general pain disappeared. I felt quite light. I tried to think what had happened. I couldn't. Something like sinking asleep came, and I knew no more. How long I remained so I do not know. Since then I have been told it was about 3 weeks. I remember slowly waking up. I appeared DDB in a house very beautifully furnished, situated near the sea. The climate was glorious. I came to myself lying on what appeared to be a couch. I remember asking myself, can I be dead? Various ideas flitted into my mind. I turned my eyes round to look at the room, 17, and found someone seated by me, a man dressed in white, rather tall, with long hair, and eyes that seemed to shine like living centers of light. He said, my brother, you have left the physical world, you are for the moment under my charge in my habitation. The place, I afterwards learned, was on the fifth sublevel of the astral plane. He said, you have now to leave me and descend into lower forms of matter. There you will remain for a time, after which you will be again restored to my charge until I pass you on to those above me. I could not grasp what was meant, all seemed so extraordinary. More than once I thought I was dreaming. As he spoke, in a peculiar way the whole of the room, he himself, and the view appeared to undergo an extraordinary change. They appeared to become less and less clear in outline till at last they faded away. I was conscious of a wonderful effect of colored streams of light, then as these faded away a strange feeling of dreariness came over me, of cold and drab surroundings. I was lying on the ground, around me nothing but desert and huge rocks. I was very miserable and lonely, and did not know what to do. The cold feeling seemed to focus my thoughts. I moved, found I could move with great freedom. I had no, 18, sense of weight. I stood up and gazed around. The sense of dreariness became more marked, and I asked myself, where am I? I saw no form, but I heard a voice reply, "You are under my charge on the third level of the region beyond the physical." I saw no form. The voice seemed to strike a chill through me. Then of a sudden I seemed to be back in England, in London, drifting, floating through the streets. At last I found myself in the neighborhood of Leicester Square, in the midst of a crowd all jostling one another. It is necessary here to condense, rather than to set down in his own words, my friend's narrative. He describes himself as having been in life a man with a very ardent feeling for the other sex, though with refined tastes and habits. But he was now plunged in the midst of the coarsest manifestations of that feeling. Without seeking the experience, he was drawn, sucked as it were, into the consciousness of a man of very gross nature and habits, and shared, though with loathing and disgust, his emotions as he gratified his desires. My friend was irresistibly tied to this man for a long time, till at last, with a horrified cry for help, he was enabled to break away, with a sense of extraordinary relief. But he was still, 19, floating over London. I resume his narrative in his own words. What a wonderful sense of relief seemed to thrill through me when free from that horrible embrace. I remember at the time floating over the Café Monaco, attracted by a swirling movement that seemed like a whirlwind to draw me into it. I tried to resist the suction, but was drawn on down through what seemed a funnel of smoke. I had no idea where I should land. But all of a sudden I found myself in a clear atmosphere listening to the conversation of two men, one a young fellow of about 20, the other a man of 45 or 50, talking in low tones. I could not hear exactly, but could feel an intense sensation of anguish that seemed to emanate from the younger man. This was very intense, and made me uncomfortable. Suddenly I heard the voice of the young man saying, "I cannot face it, I can't. It is impossible." I had no idea as to what this referred to, but could see that it was the cause of his miserable condition. The young man rose hastily, put on his hat, took his coat over his arm, and quitted the long low room. I was compelled to follow, and floated on behind him. For some time he stood on the step hesitating, then made up his mind. I saw his aura, till, 20, then a mass of grey, become dense, so that when I attempted to touch it, it was quite hard. I was compelled to follow. He called a cab and drove to some rooms near the Marble Arch. He entered the house with a key, went upstairs, entered a back room, went straight to a drawer, which he opened, and took out a revolver. I knew what he was about to do, and horror ran through me. I could do nothing, but was rooted to the place. I saw him take the revolver and look at it. Then he sat down at a table where there were writing materials and began to write to his mother. When he had finished, he folded and addressed the letter, and then put his hand on the revolver. At this moment I was in a state difficult to describe. At all costs I must prevent him, and I did not know what to do. My agony caused me to cry, "For God's sake, stop!" At this moment he gave a start, crying out, "Who spoke?" He had heard me. I tried to speak, but could not. Again he asked, "Who spoke?" I was suffering in an extraordinary way, and said, "For God's sake, spare his life." Then I was aware of a form standing by him that I have since known to have been that of the Blessed Lord, the Holy Master. I shall never forget the calmness and peace that, 21, came over me in presence of the glorious divine man. I thought it was an angel. I felt happy. All would be well. The Holy One turned his eyes on me, and I felt a thrill through my whole being. The young man in the meantime looked very startled, and put down the revolver on the table again, and sat down, looking round. I felt rather than heard him say, "Why can't I do it? I must. I can't face it." Then he took up the revolver again, and a strange thing happened. The master merely waved his hand in the direction of the young man and a stream of light seemed to flow from his fingers into the aura. Then I saw the astral form of the young man standing by the master. I did not then understand it, but have since learned that the master had drawn him out of the body. The young man sobbed as if his heart would break, and then the master put him back into his body, which had fallen on the floor. He got up in a dazed sort of way, and said, "Preserved by God himself." Then he put away the revolver, and the whole scene faded away. I was again alone. For a little time after that experience I seemed to be surrounded by a peculiar cloud, 22, which seemed to obscure my sense of sight, a cloud of a reddish tinge, and it seemed to be drifting upon me, as far as I could judge. I did not appear to be the origin of it myself, and became conscious of an extraordinary sense of damp heat and that I was slowly drifting I knew not whither. How long I drifted I know not, but at last I found myself in a dense kind of fog. I became conscious of voices, at first dim and far off, also aware of an acute, uncomfortable sensation of choking. All of a sudden the mist cleared away and I found myself in a room with a number of men and women. Now again I am constrained to condense the story. The scene was one of very degraded debauchery. I saw foul shapes of an extraordinary order floating round the room, one exactly like a large jellyfish. As it passed me it gave me an indescribable sensation of disgust and horror. I prayed to be delivered from this wretched condition, and then, to my astonishment, saw a figure approaching surrounded by an atmosphere of beautiful blue. It seemed to glide rather than walk. As it came near, my horror vanished. Then I was taken by the hand, and the voice said, "Come with me." I could not, 23, see the face of the figure, but willingly followed. We appeared to go an immense way, and at last arrived at what appeared to be a very rocky and desolate land. I was led upward along a small valley or ravine, and at last reached a small log house. My guide was behind, impelling me forward. The door of the hut opened, and I entered. I turned round to look at him who had saved me, and it was one whom he recognized as having known formerly in life. It was he who had brought me from that loathsome scene. Shall I ever forget the deep gratitude in my heart for what he had done for me? He smiled gently, and said, "My friend, I have been permitted by my master to help you. You must rest in this place for some little time. Remain patient. Do not long for those scenes that I have relieved you from." I thought at the time that was a strange remark, as I felt a powerful loathing for the scenes I had just left. He read my thought, for he went on to say, "You do not realize for the moment what this means, but those conditions will again recur, and unless you put them from you your sufferings will continue. I must leave you now, but remember that you are being guarded. You will not be left alone. Farewell." 24 He then vanished, and I was alone. So strange, so dreary were my surroundings that I almost wept, and finally began to long for the warmth of those horrible conditions in which I should not be so utterly alone. As my thought dwelt upon them I heard a voice saying, "Remember." This changed the current of my thoughts, and I realized very acutely that I must not think of those things. I was so overcome, however, that I sank to the ground, weeping violently. I know not how long this continued, but at last I felt someone touch my shoulder. I looked up. It was my friend again, smiling sweetly and sympathetically. All he said was, "Come." I rose up, feeling strengthened, and followed him. And thus the painful part of G.R.'s astral experiences came to an end. He, as I said before, had great volumes of spiritual karma behind the unsatisfied passions of his last life. Moreover, I am inclined to believe that the disagreeable period described must have been to some extent traceable to unfulfilled tendencies of earlier lives. When he was finally free of all this, he ascended into lofty realms and came by degrees to play an important part in the mighty work of the 25 Great White Lodge. It is this development that has enabled him to survey the past experiences with a clear vision and to give me the deeply interesting story I have just reproduced. 26. W. G.S. Experiences. I will now deal with another narrative of a very different order from the last. In this case I have not been able to get quite so much detail as G. R., from his present advanced point of view, was enabled to furnish. The person whose experiences I have to relate, let me here call him W. G., was not at a stage of spiritual growth rendering possible, quite as yet, for him such definite occult advancement as that ultimately reached by G.R. But, on the other hand, he was a man of remarkably beautiful nature. He was an intimate friend of mine down here, and I do not think I have ever known, in this life, a man so utterly free as he was from any moral blemish. He was certainly one of the most unselfish men I ever knew, amiable, simple, and modest to an unusual degree, and of a warmly affectionate nature. He died at an advanced age, about 77, I think. His wife, to whom, 27, he was devotedly attached, was with him at the last. 2 or 3 years had elapsed since his passing when I had the opportunity of getting into touch with him. I ought to explain that he had been in life cordially appreciative of theosophical teaching, though he would never claim to be a student, as his modesty of character made him rather inclined to underrate his intellectual qualifications, not perhaps absolutely of a first-rate order, but in no way defective. He was content to drift quietly through life doing his duty, whatever that might be, and more than doing it when circumstances gave him the opportunity of doing kindness to other people. The notes I have of my conversations with him in reference to his after-death experiences do not enable me to give the story actually in the first person. But, far from being embellished as I shall present it, it must lose a good deal in condensation. He remembered his death but quite well. He had long been ill, and faded away at the end in utter weakness rather than in pain. He tells me he lay there very happy, feeling borne up by the rosy clouds of his wife's love, and fell asleep. He woke, he does not know after what interval. It seemed to him, 28, at once, but of course we know that in all such cases as this there is a period of unconscious rest on the astral plane before the person passing on really awakes. The interval varies within very wide limits, and may be estimated sometimes in hours of our time, sometimes in months. My friend woke finding himself lying on a couch in a beautiful room. He saw his father and mother, who of course had passed over a great many years previously, and others of his people standing round. Bringing over from his last stage of consciousness the feeling that he was weak, he made an effort to get up, and found that he was weak no longer. He got up and greeted his people, and asked where was his wife. Then, you know, he told me, the door opened and she came in. I have already said that his wife survived him, and of course the explanation of her appearance was that higher powers interested in his happiness arranged the moment of his waking to correspond with a period when his wife, on this plane, was asleep, so that in the astral body she could visit her husband. All of a sudden she disappeared, but I have seen her frequently since, and am very happy. He himself, he explained, was constantly, 29, in her surroundings on the physical plane, and sent her through me ardent messages of affection. It was a beautiful house, he told me, in which he was living, in company with many very nice people, but not people whom he had known in life down here. This condition illustrates a well-known fact connected with astral life on the higher levels, where people are drawn together by natural sympathies, not, as with us down below, by karmic ties that may not always represent harmonious relations. The house, he told me, was a very fine place, smothered in pictures. But these puzzled him greatly, for as he looked at them the figures represented seemed living, moving about, and yet when he touched them they were the same as the surface of the wall. I can't understand it, he said, using a phrase he had often, in his intellectual modesty, repeated in physical life. I asked if he had not seen any people he knew in life. Oh, yes. I was out walking one time, or at least it was not walking exactly, but I was gliding along somehow in a delicious way looking at things, all very interesting, when I saw someone coming that I thought I knew, and it was, mentioning the name of one we both knew in life who has passed on to very high levels of spiritual exaltation. She had, 30, come down to pay me a visit, and I have also been honored by a visit from the Master. At the time of this conversation my friend was simply reveling in the first exhilarating sensation of happiness which was the natural background of his new life, well up on the fourth sub-level of the astral plane. Even on that level there are many varieties of condition, and I take it that he for many reasons was in the enjoyment of some among the best.